ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Hawley, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, the government faces its first big test of the year at the Dunkley by-election. Just how badly has the cost of living crisis hit Labor? Also, with extreme heat in Kalgoorlie, a power blackout puts residents and health services under pressure. And the search is on for a new set of feathers, so Stan, the wedge-tailed eagle, can get back into the sky.
So we know he is a boy, so we know we need to find boy feathers. We have weights on him, we've got feather length measurements, and so we're going to give that out to all the hospitals and see if anyone has, you know, a donor that matches. And then hopefully we can release him.
But first tonight, it's going to be a big test for the standing of the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and the Labor government. The date for a crucial federal by-election for the Melbourne seat of Dunkley has now been announced for March the 2nd. It was caused by the death of the former Labor MP, Peter Murphy, at the end of last year. The ABC's chief election analyst is Anthony Green. Anthony Green, opinion polling has been showing that Labor has been losing ground. That's right, isn't it? So this is a pretty crucial by-election, I would have thought, for Anthony Albanese.
Well, the national polling's not strong enough. The shift hasn't been big enough to determine that the by-election is going to fall. Yes. But as is normally the case, there is a swing against the government at by-elections. Now, last year at the Aston by-election, we saw that real breach when the actual government gained a seat from the opposition with a swing of 6.4%. Now, if the government has a swing against it of 6.3, basically reverse of Aston, then they would lose Dunkley. Dunkley, on paper, is a safe seat at 6.3, but it's only safe because the Labor Party performance in Victoria has been very strong for a number of years and the Liberal Party position weak. It sits about that pivot point in Victoria between the Labor and the Liberal seats. It's a natural marginal seat. It's an outer suburban seat. So it's the sort of seat that some in the Liberal Party have been talking out up as a possible gain to overcome the problem of Teals winning inner city seats. So it's a sort of a by-election which is a really strong test of where the two parties are sitting at the moment. Right. It's in Victoria, which is not representative of the rest of Australia at the moment, given how strong Labor is down there.
Yes.
But it's also an outer suburban seat where the Liberal Party are hoping to do well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not certain, even though, as you mentioned, Labor has a really strong standing in Victoria. It sounds like what you're saying is it's not a given that Labor will win this by-election.
No, it's a by-election. It's in a seat. The swings are normally against the government. The average since Federation is about 4%. The average over the last 40 years is about 3.5%. It's about 4.5% to 5% in seats which are held by the government. And the Labor Party over the years in Adelaide, in Oxley, in Canberra, have suffered really big swings at by-elections. So, you know, it's set up. It could potentially be that. Cost of living would bite in that electorate. Interest rates would bite in parts of that electorate. So it's all set up. It's on its current boundaries, it's probably more likely to be a Labor seat given the overall result in Victoria. But, you know, this is a by-election. The voters can go out there. They can express an opinion on how the Albanese government's been performing without actually putting the government at risk. So it's exactly that sort of climate where the electorate can send a message without actually defeating
the
government.
So an important test of the national mood to start the year.
Yeah, it's certainly in that sort of seat. As I said, it is in Victoria, which means that the Labor Party's probably got a better chance of holding it than if it was in some other states. But still, I think even since last year, the Aston by-election, the mood in Victoria has changed a bit. Daniel Andrews has moved on. There's a new Premier. But the Liberal Party internally in Victoria has continued to have bickering. The Liberal Party has picked a relatively high-profile candidate in Nathan Conroy, who's the mayor of Frankston, so he has some profile in the area. And the Labor candidate, Jodie Bellier, I think the name is pronounced, certainly she's got sort of a lot of involvement with community groups in the area. So it's going to be a sort of bit of a combination of the campaign on the ground between two relatively good candidates and the campaign between the two parties about what's the message the electorate of Dunkley wants to send to Canberra.
Mm, and as you say, cost of living will be a key message that both parties will be talking about. But it sounds like the government will really be sweating on this one. What sort of contest do you think we'll see on the ground? You know, it's going to be fierce campaigning, I would have thought.
Well, the government wants to hold the seat and the opposition wants to make the swing as big as possible. So it is a competitive by-election. It's a seat which the government will want to hold. I mean, if it loses it, it doesn't bring down the government.
Mm.
It doesn't tell you what's going to happen at the next election. It's a by-election, you know, in a place at a time when the government probably wouldn't want one, but it's got one. And the Liberal Party, it's not in the state where the party's in its best health at the moment. But still, they should be able to pull together enough of a campaign in that seat to make it competitive.
All right. Interesting few weeks ahead then.
Thank you.
Anthony Green, thank you. The ABC's chief election analyst, Anthony Green. Both the government and the Reserve Bank have been told they're not doing enough to stem Australia's cost of living crisis. The warnings come from the United Nations Finance Agency, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. It says record levels of immigration and ongoing government infrastructure spending are adding too much demand to the economy and will keep inflation higher for longer. And of course, that means the possibility of further rate hikes, as David Taylor reports.
The IMF wasn't short of praise for the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, and his management of the economy in its annual Australian Economic Health Check. Its report states,
sizable fiscal consolidation has continued to help bring the economy to a soft landing. Directors welcomed the authority's progress on fiscal consolidation and commitment to debt sustainability.
Then came the but. The IMF's worried the Albanese government is stimulating the economy too much with infrastructure spending.
Implementing public investment projects at a more measured pace would support disinflation efforts.
Former Treasury economist Warren Hogan agrees.
And it's not just the federal government. In fact, I think the state governments are more liable for increasing the size of their spend over the last 5 years. I really would warn against cutting back on infrastructure too much. Sure, there's construction industry bottlenecks and they need to pace it, but I think the main focus needs to be on government making sure that they're ongoing commitments are not growing much further. We're literally getting size of government in Australia back to where it was in the 1970s.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, is putting a positive spin on the report. He told PM in a statement, quote, "The IMF has once again joined the chorus of voices supporting the government's responsible economic management." Adding, the IMF backs our fiscal strategy, which has seen us already deliver the first surplus in 15 years, and with a second in prospect.
And certainly the government has shown restraint in the face of unexpected revenues. But is that going to get the job done on inflation? Is the government doing enough to bring the cost of living down with its fiscal policy? There are hints in the IMF report that there could be more done to get inflation down quicker and take pressure off Australian families quicker.
In a bombshell finding, the IMF report says interest rates should be
tightened further to ensure inflation comes back to target earlier than 2026.
They're running models that are telling them clearly that the RBA has not done enough to get inflation down and that they shouldn't be taking so much time to get inflation down because it risks dislodging or de-anchoring inflation expectations. So at the one time, it is a bit surprising that they've come up so strongly on both the fiscal and monetary policy commentary. But at the same time, I tend to agree with their sentiments. Although at the moment, the RBA looks firmly on hold. We'll have to see how the economy plays out over the first sort of 3 or 4 months of the year.
The IMF's also calling for more tax reform, arguing government coffers should rely more on the GST and less on personal income tax.
David Taylor reporting. More tensions are brewing across the Middle East, with Pakistan conducting a series of retaliatory missile strikes on Iran. Iran's become a focal point of hostility in the region through its proxies in Lebanon and Yemen, and more recently through targeted strikes on three of its regional allies, Pakistan, Syria, and Iraq. While experts say Iran is unlikely to want to escalate these conflicts, it does run the risk of inflaming tensions in the region further. Flint Duxfield reports.
This morning, Pakistan undertook a series of highly coordinated military strikes against terrorist hideouts in Iran.
Just days after the Iranian military struck Israel-linked militant bases inside the Pakistani province of Balochistan, the announcement that Pakistan had responded with strikes of its own has heightened concerns of yet another regional conflict emerging. The United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has called for restraint, as has the US State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We are concerned about escalating tensions in the region. We've been incredibly concerned about the potential for escalation since October 7th, and that's why we have engaged in intense diplomatic efforts to try to prevent escalation.
Iran's strikes in Pakistan come after attacks on what it claims were Israeli spy headquarters in Iraq, near the US consulate. It's also hit targets linked to the extremist group Islamic State in northern Syria. While Pakistan and Iran have had frosty relations in the past, Syria and Iraq are some of Iran's closest allies. So why is it launching attacks on the territory of its strategic partners? Suzanne Maloney is the Director of Foreign Policy at the Washington DC-based Brookings Institution. She says while the missiles fell in Iraq and Syria, the real targets were Israel and the United States.
The hope is to force the United States to pull back from its posture in the region, both its direct and ongoing support to Israel's war in Gaza, but also, of course, the longstanding American military presence in various parts of the region. With respect to Israel, what the Iranians are hoping to do is to ensure that the Israelis are not able to succeed in their war aims to eradicate Hamas in its entirety. As long as the Israelis don't win, the Iranians will perceive that as a victory.
As well as equipping and training Hamas fighters, Iran supports the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthi rebels in Yemen, both of which have increased their aggression towards Israel since the escalation of conflict last October. With the United States recently launching airstrikes on Houthi forces in Yemen in an effort to stop the group disrupting shipping in the Red Sea, Suzanne Maloney believes Iran was forced to respond.
I think they were primarily face-saving measures that the Iranians undertook after the United States hit at Iranian proxy groups across the region. So what we're seeing really is a kind of calibrated exchange of hostilities between the United States, Iran, and various proxy groups.
As the largest Shia Muslim country in the world, Iran believes it has a key role in supporting other Shia groups in the region. Dr. Dalbir Alawat is an expert in security studies at Macquarie University. He says with several of these Shia groups under attack, Iran is in a difficult position.
So if they do not get support from Iran, they will be subdued soon. So it's a matter of status for Iran that the Shia Muslims should have their own level of identity. And to safeguard that, if it does not support them, then the Shia is being getting limited to Iran also. It will be wiped away from other places.
Despite the US maintaining sanctions against the country since the 1980s, Iran has the largest military in the region, with a ballistic missile capability eclipsing all other Middle Eastern countries, including Israel. If it were to be pulled into a direct conflict with Israel, that would risk the United States becoming involved. But Dr. Alawat says he doesn't believe Iran is interested in using its own military in a broader conflict.
Iran is a very pragmatic country. They know their limitations. So they are using the proxies, proxy fighters. This way, their economy is not drained. Their military fellows are not being killed. Therefore, I think it will continue through its proxies.
The Brookings Institution's Suzanne Maloney agrees that Iran doesn't want to risk a conflict with the United States, but she says there's no guarantees that won't occur.
The longer it goes, the more opportunities there are for miscalculation or for catastrophic success, which then brings in the possibility of a much more significant war in which Washington would be a party rather than an offshore balancer.
Susan Maloney from the Brookings Institution, ending that report from Flint, Duxfield. This is PM with me, Samantha Hawley, and you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Music. Jewish and Islamic communities in Australia say there's been a rise in hate speech since the start of the Israel-Gaza war. That's prompted the New South Wales government to launch a review into the state's incitement to violence and hate speech laws, which haven't led to a conviction since they were introduced in 2018. A former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has been appointed to assess whether the laws need strengthening. Rachel Hayter reports.
From the river to the sea!
From the river to the sea!
The violence in the Middle East is being felt deeply by the Palestinian and Jewish diaspora here in Australia. But the New South Wales government is worried that feeling is being expressed in harmful ways. The state's police minister is Yasmin Catley.
There is no place in this state for hate speech, full stop. That is why the government has asked one of the greatest legal minds in this state to look at the legislation to ensure that it is fit for purpose.
Former Chief Justice of the New South Wales Supreme Court, Tom Bathurst, will conduct a review of laws regulating incitement to violence. The state's Acting Attorney General, Ron Hennig, says the objectives and effectiveness of Section 93Z of the Crimes Act will be examined.
We need to make sure that whilst they have a right to free speech, that free speech does not become hate speech.
The review will also look at similar laws in other jurisdictions, including the United Kingdom. The CEO of Faith New South Wales is Murray Norman.
The reason that we're so keen on this is this law was put in place. It was put in place to connect the whole community, not one community. And as yet, the police haven't been able to use it in an instance to be able to stop threats.
The Executive Council of Australian Jewry says they'll be commencing civil proceedings against Islamic clerics they accuse of anti-Semitic sermons since October 7. The council's co-CEO is Peter Wertheim, who believes the current laws are not fit for purpose.
One of the problems with the current law, not only in New South Wales, I think this applies elsewhere as well, is the use of the word incite in the criminal legislation. The word incite has a very narrow and constricted meaning in law, and it's notoriously difficult to prove incitement beyond reasonable doubt.
Palestinian organiser Fahad Ali is less optimistic about the review.
What is distressing is that this review was prompted not by a resurgence of hate speech necessarily, but by discomfort with the legitimate political speech of Palestinians and our supporters by saying things like, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which has been widely claimed by our detractors, people who are against Palestinian sovereignty and self-determination, to be a call to violence.
The Law Society of New South Wales has welcomed the review, but its president, Brett McGrath, has warned it must hear from experts.
We've seen unintended consequences flow from changes, particularly to the criminal law, when governments haven't listened to the experts before legislating, which unfortunately can lead to confusion and ambiguity. So we're hoping that there's going to be clarity on the vilification laws through this review.
Nicole Asquith is a professor of policing and emergency management at the University of Tasmania. She's also welcomed the review in New South Wales. She believes while the law is needed in extreme cases, the courts are not necessarily the right place to address either vilification or hate speech.
Too often, I think, you know, where we see that there has been increased criminalisation of speech, that it has been those that are most vulnerable and marginalised who end up in court and who end up in prisons for hate-related crimes. And we may not, in fact, capture those that have the most amount of harm on the communities more generally.
She's also researched the link between hate speech and hate crime.
In terms of threats of death and violence, often that hate speech is not followed by actions, that it's almost a proxy for the action of killing or hurting somebody.
In a statement, the New South Wales Council for Civil Liberties says it hopes the review will involve extensive community consultation. It says it's concerned New South Wales Police has been given power to launch prosecutions under Section 93Z and that police have not overcome entrenched hostility to some vulnerable communities.
Rachel Hayter reporting. We know major storms can cause blackouts, but how would you like to go without power for an entire week in sweltering temperatures? That's what tens of thousands of residents of Australia's largest outback town, Kalgoorlie, were warned of after severe storms hit Western Australia's goldfields and wheatbelt. It wasn't just power. Communication networks, petrol stations and water supplies were also hit. As Isabel Mosali reports, experts are urging Australian communities to be better prepared for similar disasters.
At Gloria Moyle's Women's Healthcare Centre in Kalgoorlie, an extended power outage meant closing the doors. Seeing patients was deemed too unsafe.
The last couple of days, I have to tell you, were quite challenging. Everybody banded together here as a community to survive, I guess. And I know that sounds quite dramatic, but that's what we were doing. You know, it was a heat wave. We had no power. We had no access. We had SOS on our phones. So, you know, it was quite challenging.
Earlier this week, a severe storm caused significant damage to transmission lines that feed into WA's biggest outback town. While power was largely being restored today, authorities had warned people to be prepared for outages of up to 7 days. There were at least 20 heat-related presentations at local hospitals, and residents drove 80 kilometres one way to fill up their cars. A similar situation happened a few years ago in what locals dubbed the Cowpocalypse, but Gloria Moyle hoped it wouldn't happen again to the gold mining town.
You know, I think we're very frustrated. We have, you know, one of the richest gold moles in this nation, and I think that that investment needs to be put back into the people. We should not in 2024 be experiencing the isolation and the lack of electricity, water and telephone lines that we did.
Part of the Perth Hills and towns across the wheat belt have also been impacted. David Singe is the CEO of the Shire of Dowran, where power has been affected since Tuesday. He's welcomed the return of Telstra services last night.
We could ring out, but no one could contact us. And that's pretty bad, you know, when the 000 system is inaccessible. So that will have applied to lots of people, lots of places. Tuesday night, there was a fire over at Wongan Hills. There was a call to evacuate the hospital patients. We would normally help, and our guy here said no one could get hold of us. We didn't know anything about it.
WA Premier Roger Cook notes communities on the East Coast have previously seen power outages lasting weeks, but he still labels this situation extreme and has requested an investigation into the resilience of the state's power grid. He says in the future there may be wide-scale outages from more frequent and severe weather events.
Backup generators did kick in, but tripped straight away. But I don't think they were fit for purpose in terms of such a severe outage right across the region. But so we need to look at that, and I've asked Minister Whitby to provide me with some advice in relation to that, but also to provide the government with advice in relation to making sure that our system is resilient.
Dr. Sophie Adams is a research fellow at Deakin University and examines the impacts of climate change in the energy sector. She stresses power outages can have devastating and cascading effects, and while WA's electricity network operates differently to other states, there are still broader lessons to be learnt.
This event shows that it's really critical the backup is in place already, that it's maintained and ready to go. It also shows that there may be a need for backups to the backup, as it were, and they could include things like smaller scale generators for individual households or businesses or community buildings. Or those other solutions such as solar and battery systems that may not depend on access to fuel and the fuel supply chain in the same way.
Dr. Adams says another approach that could make communities more resilient is microgrids, and that's being adopted in some locations across Australia, including Mallacoota in Victoria, which was impacted by the Black Summer bushfires.
A microgrid allows communities to continue to access power even when the border grid is down. They essentially are operating as a little island, and it doesn't enable the full extent usually of the or energy use that you normally have access to with the main grid. So it is important to sort of prioritise those needs and really only use the things that are most essential. But in the event of that broader outage, being able to access those essential things can be really critical.
Dr. Sophie Adams from Deakin University, ending that report from Isabel Massali. Now, you're going to like this one. Vets in Byron Bay are on the search for a set of feathers for an injured wedge-tailed eagle. Affectionately known as Stan, it was found on a family farm and needs a feather transplant so it can fly again. But finding a perfect match is proving difficult. Elizabeth Cramsey has this report.
At the Byron Bay Wildlife Hospital, a wedge-tailed eagle named Stan is undergoing a pretty bizarre procedure. Stan was found on a property at Stanthorpe by 11-year-old Darby while out on a motorbike ride.
I didn't quite know what it was from a couple hundred metres away, but then I got closer and realised him, so I hopped off and went over for a walk over to him, and he couldn't fly, and he was just kind of hobbling around.
Quick thinking Darby raced back to his mum to let her know there was an animal in need of help.
We went down with the horse rug and then put it over him and then put him in the back of the ute, and then we put him, mum had a look at him and had a look at his feathers and that. Then we put him in the big horse float, and then for a few days we gave him mince cubes from the supermarket. And then the next couple days after that, we gave him some rabbits and he loved that.
But as Darby's mother Kendall realised, Stan would need professional care.
He was a very easy bird to have around. He wasn't hostile, but I knew that he needed expert attention. We get lots of wildlife that you help, and normally it's something that they just need a bit of a hand for a few days and then off they go again. But it was different for him. We knew that there's no way he's going to be able to survive without being able to fly.
So they popped him in the car, where he very patiently sat in a crate on the seat next to Darby, and set out on a three-hour drive to Byron Bay to meet Dr. Bree Talbot.
He was quite bright and quite aware of what was going on, but he had all this damage to his primary flight feathers, which are the ones that actually give him that lift to be able to get up into the air. And because these had all been broken off, he couldn't fly. So he'd been on the ground for a little bit.
Stan needs a feather transplant, a procedure known as imping.
Imping is where we take feathers from a donor bird, so a bird that has unfortunately lost its life to either disease or trauma. And so we harvest those feathers and we store them in a feather bank. We unfortunately did not have the feathers required for him. However, one of our really great local wildlife carers and raptor rehabilitators, Mel Barsony, had several feathers that she thought could work.
Stan needs 10 feathers replaced, and eventually they will grow back on their own. But that could take up to 12 months, much longer than the vets would like to keep a wild bird in captivity.
We assessed him under anaesthetic to see if these feathers would fit. And it sounds like, you know, a feather is a feather. However, raptors and birds, their feathers actually are unique to their species, to their age and to their sex. And so we had to figure out which feathers would fit him so that, you know, they would still give him the best aerodynamics and give him the best sort of, you know, chance of being able to fly again. And unfortunately, with the three sets of feathers that we had, none of them fit him properly.
They've put the call out for other hospitals around the country to check their own feather banks.
So it sounds a little bit morbid, but we sort of cut the bird's wing off and we keep them all aligned properly and they're all still within the muscle and on the bone, and then we freeze them. So we freeze the whole wing, and that allows us to keep it in the best condition.
And it's quite a process to find the perfect match.
So we know we need to find boy feathers. We have weights on him. We've got feather length measurements. And so we're going to give that out to all the hospitals and see if anyone has, you know, a donor that matches. If we do, we'll see if we can get them transported up. and then we'll go through the whole procedure again of anaesthetising him, and then it's a really meticulous procedure where they're actually implanted onto his feathers, so we cut them down so that we can implant them on, and then hopefully we'll check that he can fly. And then hopefully we can release him.
When he can be released, Darby and Kendall will be ready to take Stan home.
Yeah, Ruby Rest is the name of the place. So that will be a very exciting day, won't it, Darby?
Kendall Moore ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Lena Elsardi, David Sargent and Joel Chasm. I'm Samantha Hawley. The PM team will be back on Monday evening with David Lipson back in the chair. Thanks for your company this week. Have a lovely evening. Good night.